The Queer Family Podcast. Love is love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love.
With the transfers, there's you have to do STD testing, you have to do this sperm samples, all these things. So there was a couple times that I had to go without Philip because, like, why are you coming with me for these medical tests you don't have to do? And I had to sit in this room and I literally FaceTimed Philip and was like showing him the next round of women because the first one didn't work out. And so we landed on someone else. And after she came in, the clinic literally said to us, they were like, we think she's the one. Like, she's been so incredible. And also, she is just beautiful. Like, she was just so much more beautiful than her photos. Like, this is the one for you for sure.
Welcome, y'all, to the Queer Family Podcast, the show all about family, but with gay. The show that highlights, celebrates, uplifts, and normalizes LGBTQIA+ families and all of our fabulous identities. And this one is a really good one. It's a fabulous one, as they all are. They're all my babies. I love them all the same. And this one is also a really good one. I got to sit down with Phil and Jonathan. They're two dads who had quite a journey. And I just want to say, like, lately, I feel like a lot of us are asking the same questions, like with the state of the U.S. and the state of the world right now, and the regime we seem to find ourselves under that just keeps on keeping on at us all. I've been wondering a lot recently, is this going to affect my family? Is this going to affect my marriage? Is this going to affect my children? And I'm sure a lot of you are having these thoughts too, these worries, these fears. I mean, how can we not when you just hear constantly, oh, they're trying to take away gay marriage again. Oh, and we talk about it in this episode. But, like, is it going to affect us? And is it going to affect us being able to create our families the ways that we want to? There's intention. There's cost. There's heartbreak. And sometimes years of trying before anything works. And today's story is exactly that. It's adoption that didn't happen. It's a pandemic that changed everything. And it's a completely unexpected turn that led to the family that they were always meant to have. Mm. And honestly, it's a reminder that no matter how much you plan this out, no matter how much, the unexpected is always going to happen. And it's not going to turn out the way you always dreamed it would. But you're always going to get what you were meant to have. And that's beautiful. So I really want to roll this tape with Phil and Jonathan. They're a beautiful guy. I love it. Love the conversation with them. So much great stuff. But before I do, I want to tell you all about the thing that's happening over on the Patreon. So if you're not on Patreon, which I understand if you're not, I'm always like overwhelmed and never have enough time to actually put really great stuff up. But now with Deani helping me out, we have some ideas. We're going to start something new on Patreon, which we talked about in the last episode. We're going to be doing like a little behind the scenes extra bonus content that only gets released on Patreon. And it's really just kind of like a Jamie spilling of the tea of a lot of the things that she doesn't always put into these here episodes. I mean, there's not much, but there is much because, you know, like I have to be sensitive on this show of my guests. I have to be, and of course, I'm always sensitive of my guests and I love them, but I have to be sensitive. I have to be sensitive of any sponsors I have. So I don't say everything I think on this here show, but on Patreon, I am going to be saying a little bit more than what you hear here. And I honestly, when Deani and I came up with this idea, I was thinking, oh my God, I don't know if I'm going to have enough to talk about. Like, what am I going to, I don't know, maybe. So I sat down just a little bit ago to jot down some ideas of topics we can cover. And y'all, I got a long list real quickly. So there are things I want to get off my chest. And I think y'all will appreciate them because I think we're mostly all of us on the same page. So if you're not on Patreon, head on over to Patreon at the Queer Family Podcast. There is a free side to Patreon as well. So if you don't have the money, I will try to release some of these things on the free side here and there. But if you have a little extra money, and it's not much, you can do it as little as $2 a month. If you have a little extra money in your pocketbooks, I mean, who does right now? So this might all be a flop, but please head over to Patreon, support me there, and you're going to get some spilling the tea of Jamie getting shit off her chest that she has held inside. You might even hear me bitch about my wife here and there. Don't tell her I said that. OMG. I need to have a nice night tonight. Okay. All right. Let's... What am I getting myself into? Let's roll the tape. Head to Patreon. Do the thing. Make sure you're following on all the socials, because some of the content might show up here and there on the socials at the Queer Family Podcast, everywhere you can find us. And also, like, subscribe to this here show and put comments in there and nice reviews for me, please. Now that I've asked you to do everything you can possibly do, let's roll this tape and hopefully you get something beautiful out of it. And hang in there, folks. These times are trying. And I hope this is a little bit of light in your day. All right. All right. Helen, Beulah, let's roll this tape.
Queer Family Podcast, love is love.
Hi, Jonathan and Phil.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
You're doing good. Excited to do this.
Yeah, I'm excited too. I can't wait to hear your story. I can't wait to hear all of it. Without further ado, let's do this. Let's get into your 30-second elevator pitch. It's just a fun way to get to know who you are and why you're here talking to the Queer Fam Squad. Are we ready?
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. Get set. Go.
I'm Phil, an author of Queer Books for Kids and Teens. My husband, Jonathan, owns a luxury wedding planning company in New York. We've been together since 2010, and we spent a long time focusing on our careers before building our family. Now, that journey was challenging. A 3-year stretch of adoption, pandemic delays, and honestly, we almost gave up a few times. We decided to explore surrogacy, and everything kind of clicked when Jonathan's childhood best friend just volunteered to be our carrier. So fast forward, and speaking quickly, because I have 30 seconds, our daughter Blake is 3.5, and she will correct you if you forget the half. She loves her papa and daddy, but she is starting to realize that she's living in a very, very mommy and daddy world. So we're here to talk about our journey and offer some visibility for anyone else navigating the same path. So let's do it.
Let's do it. I love it. I love it. Okay, so this is exciting. We're talking about a couple of paths towards parenthood, basically, it seems like trying out different things. How long ago did you meet? Did you say that in your elevator pitch?
16.
Yeah, it was 2010, yeah. August of 2010. So wow. 16 years ago.
And you took some time before you started your family building journey.
Yeah, I was 22 when we met. He was 23. I just moved to Washington, D.C. after college. He had been there for about a year. So let's say we weren't like ready. we were eager to get started on that process. And we got married in 2013. The day that it was legalized in Hawaii was, I think, either the day we got engaged or the day we got married. Something. I can't remember. There was something where it was like literally on a Sunday, or Saturday, which nothing happens on Saturdays, but we were like, let's fit that into one of our speeches.
I mean, and now they're trying to take it away again. Let's go.
Shocker. Yay.
Love
it here.
Well, yeah.
Amazing. <We love it. laughs> Oh my God. Let's not get into all that. Let's talk about family. I would love to know, when did the first conversation about family happen? Because I know you didn't start for quite some time, but when did you start talking about it?
I feel like it was always a part of the conversation. Like, I personally knew I always wanted to have a family and kids. And that was one of my, like, I remember before I had come out, it was like the fear of not being able to have a family and thinking that it was impossible. So it was definitely something that was always on the table. And I would say a deal breaker for me specifically is like, I wouldn't have dated somebody that wasn't in the realm of possibility. So even though we weren't actively trying to have a family because we were so young, it was definitely something we had always discussed and knew we would want eventually.
Yeah, I feel like it's probably something we discussed on like the first or second date.
I think we usually do, because not only do we have to, like all couples, you do have to get on the same page on whether we want kids or not. Like, all couples have to do that, but we have way more things to talk through than just that.
Yeah, it's a commitment.
Yeah, and we need to make sure we're on the same page about how we want to go about it. Do you care about genetics? I care about genetics. So how are we going to do that? You know what I mean? Like, all these things that need to be hashed out.
And like, a conversation with a 22 and a 23-year-old probably doesn't have any of those answers or know what the questions are. So that's why we had iterations of that conversation that got more and more complex year after year. And it got a bit intimidating.
Totally. Well, yeah, because there are so many decisions to make and there's no rule book. There's no guidelines except podcasts like this and a few books here and there. There's more lately, like more and more is coming out, but it's still like putting a puzzle together and trying to grasp and do what your gay friends before you did. And okay, let's take from that part and let's do, you know, like it's a mess. It's a mix up.
State by state, it varies very greatly. So we read books and they'd be like, well, if you're in this state or if you're in this state or if you're in this, it's like, okay, I'm already, again, overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Like,
it's overwhelming.
It's hard.
It is. So when you finally decided, okay, now's the time, what was the conversation and what did you think your path was going to be? Let's walk down the path. Let's go.
We always wanted to adopt, or I personally always wanted to adopt. I felt pretty strongly about not bringing life into this world, actually. I just wanted to rather give a home to a child that needed it and already existed. I didn't care so much about the genetics or passing on anything. So in my mind, it was always adoption. And the conversation like seriously ramped up around the same time Philip's first book actually came out. We kind of put it on pause just a little bit because he wanted to really focus on the success of his first book and the launch and not feel too overwhelmed. But the conversation was like, how long is adoption going to take? Should we at least be kind of getting the conversation started and the wheels moving?
We moved to New York City in 2015 after getting, we were in London and DC before that. We kind of moved everywhere. We had our fun. And when we were in New York for, you know, 4 or 5 years, we were like, okay, I think we're settled. Like, Jonathan had opened his wedding planning company. I had gotten my book deal. I also had a job in publishing. So I was like, okay, I think we're settled. Like, we're not 100% settled, but we're at least like on the right path. So it's, now's the time to answer the question. And then of course, pressures of age.
Well, and and then the pandemic hit. His book came out in February of 2020. And so the conversation was, we're going to wait until after your book comes out. And then a global pandemic happened.
Then the global pandemic,
you know, obviously threw a wrench into it. We did the whole adoption journey in that we, you know, did the home study. We found an agency we were going to work with, like interviewed with multiple agencies. We went with an agency that was based up in Buffalo, New York, and we had to fly up there for mandatory classes and did the home study in our apartment in New York. And then we also moved to Westchester during the pandemic. So we had to redo the home study once we moved here. We were in the adoption process for 2 full years.
Wow.
As a waiting family, as they call it. And we weren't getting any kind of traction at all.
That's crazy.
And it was something where we started out kind of as selective as we wanted in terms of, you can kind of, you know, there's a laundry list of things that you can say, are you open to this? Are you not open to that? And we wanted to start more selective. And then when we weren't getting any opportunity calls, we broadened it literally as wide as you could go. And we, I think, got a total of 4 opportunity calls over 2 years.
Oh my God.
Which is not enough.
No. Did they give you any indications of why?
Yes and no. So the explanation that was kind of given, and there is validity to it, is during the pandemic, there were a lot less unplanned pregnancies because people were stuck at home. And that's a terrible and sad thing to say, but people weren't going out. There was, you know, if you think about the people that are typically putting their children up for adoption, it's not a couple that's at home for the pandemic. It's people that are, you know, having these unfortunate circumstances or young people. And so when that component was taken away, I think there was less demand for sure. We worked with an agency that specifically did work with LGBT families, but you know, there's always a component too of like the expectant mother has to be willing to work with a queer family. You know, they're the first line of defense. They get to see the books first and choose whether or not we even
make the choice
considered. Yeah. And so,
right, the steps in just to take a step back and talk about the process itself. We would get the call. They would have all the details that they knew, which often they didn't know about. And then if we said, yes, we want to be put forward to it, our adoption book or like a
lookbook.
Our lookbook was sent to the mother. And then it would be one of 10 books sent over to her. And then she would narrow it down to like three or something. We never got to the narrow down phase even. And then a decision is made. And of course, oftentimes during this process, they choose not to go down the adoption route. There are so many things that can happen. But even in the best case scenario, you have it's a very slim path.
There was just more, I think, a higher demand than supply, to put it in those terms. And, you know, unfortunately, also all the calls we got were just like less than ideal, which is something that we weren't really prepared for, was the level of drug use and with it from the mothers during the pregnancy and things like this. And we just, you know, had to have a lot of you had like 24 hours to get back to them to say yes or no. And so it was going on 3 years. That's when we were like, okay, maybe this isn't the path. And my parents actually were the ones that were just like, I know you didn't want to do surrogacy for a multitude of reasons, financials being a massive one.
Huge.
But I think if this is something that you guys are serious about, like, it might be time to reevaluate or revisit this conversation now that you're 34 years old. You know, like, you're getting older, you want this, so let's figure out how to make it happen for you.
Once you start the process, you want it to happen right away, you know, so any waiting is painful.
Definitely a pivot. And obviously, ultimately, we did want the family and we were open to it. But, you know, it comes with its own hoops and challenges and finances and just a lot of different obstacles.
Yeah, let's talk through it.
Queer people who aren't able to like naturally have a child, it feels like every month we had a new conversation of, do we want to do this? Are we sure we want to do this? And I think a lot of parents, like the non-queers were like, you know what? We'll see what happens. Maybe we'll have a second.
Yeah.
Or it's like, let's wait and see. But
we're not,
even trying.
It's like,
exactly.
Yeah.
But then it's like, it kicks into gear when they're like, oops, okay, I am actually pregnant. We're in it. But there was not going to ever be that.
Yeah, it was there's an intentional choice that has to be made as a queer family.
Yes.
No matter what, like, this isn't a let's wait and see, or maybe this will happen. It's like, I have to invest a lot of time, a lot of energy, be subjected to a lot of critique, especially in the adoption world. We kind of felt like we were treated like criminals, like with the home studies and the way that they like the things that we had to have in our home in case a baby came. When you think about how a straight couple can just have a baby without anyone watching and anyone can do it. It's like, oh, but make sure all of my fire detectors are working.
Well, we had to have a bed. We had to have a bed. So think of that. We did a pack and play, not a crib, thank God. But think about having a pack and play in your closet for
years,
2.5 years.
It's a reminder. It's a reminder.
A visual reminder. It's like, it's so painful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So every day it's like, you have to consciously make this decision. Okay, we're going to keep doing this. We're going to keep going, even though it's painful, even though we don't know where this is going to end up. We don't know what we're going to have to do to get where we want to be. We don't know. It never goes the way you think it's going to go. And so I love that you said that, and because intentionality comes up so much in every single conversation I have on this show. And you really put it into great perspective there. Like, every day we had to make the decision to not stop. Either we're stopping or we're going.
And we found, you know, as we got older, and I think a lot of people in our generation too, like, as you get older, you get more set in your way of life and you've kind of been happy and you're okay with things. And so it's like, maybe we don't need this. And again, for straight people, then they can play the like, well, let's wait and see, or kind of try, or whatever it might be.
God's will.
Totally. Yeah. Leave it in God's hands for sure. So there was no accidental pregnancies happening over here. And we had to really forge ahead and make that conscious effort and decision.
Yeah, it's a commitment and it's not easy. It's heartbreaking at times.
Yes.
And there's a lot of ups and downs. All right. So you're like, okay, mom, good idea. Maybe we'll switch to surrogacy. We ain't got no money, basically.
Luckily, my parents do.
Oh, yay.
Yay,
parents.
Yay, thank you. They very generously offered to help because this was something that they knew was really important to us. I've been, you know, I have worked since I'm 14 years old. Like, we obviously live in New York and lived in New York City. Like, it's a very expensive place. And luckily, they were in a position to help. Otherwise, you know, we were having conversations when we started surrogacy with all the different agencies of the financing options. And, you know, of course, could have been in debt and found ways to make it work. But luckily we had family that was able to help us. That made it just a much easier pill to swallow that I know a lot of queer people don't have. So we're obviously very grateful for that.
It sounds like because you had a friend, it wasn't like the full package that they describe.
Yeah, she did save us a lot of money, and we'll, you know, we'll get to that too. But, you know, that when we started the conversations and the explorations, we certainly were not expecting that. That was a kind of last minute pivot, which was incredible. But yes, that definitely helped with the costs.
That's the angel right there. There's the God intervention
There she is.
So your parents say, okay, we'll help you out. So you went and you interviewed agencies, you found an agency you liked.
We actually ended up not having to work with an agency because we didn't need a surrogate. So
we had done all the research into agencies.
Totally. So luckily, my business partner and best friend that lives up here as well, she had gone through IVF to have her daughter. And so she worked with an incredible fertility clinic in New York City that also worked with LGBT families. And so we kind of just went directly to them to discuss their egg donor program. That's how we went about finding an egg donor, was through this fertility clinic. And then it became the kind of piecemeal thing of then during that process, I was, you know, lamenting to my best friend who had also been my girlfriend of 3 years in high school. Like we've known each other since 10th grade.
This is like what everybody says. Like if I grow up and I don't have a kid by the time I'm 40, I'm going to go back to this friend.
Right? It was Will and Grace. Yeah totally. So yeah, I was, you know, lamenting about just kind of the cost. And the reason this had actually started is I'm very short. I'm only 5'6". And so she's actually quite tall. And so I had texted her randomly being like, how tall are you? And she's like, why are you asking me this? And so I was like, oh, we're looking at egg donors now. And I want to choose someone who's taller to try to offset my height. And so then we had a conversation and she kind of offhandedly was like, oh, maybe this is something I could do for you. And I was like, are you being serious? Because like, if you're being serious, like, let's talk about this because like this is like the dream scenario, having my best friend carry our child, and it would just like make it such a special experience. And we, you know, still wanted to use an egg donor because we thought it would be weird for me to have a child with my best friend / ex-girlfriend. That's why we always say gestational carrier, not surrogate, which is like a distinction that most people that haven't gone through this process don't understand. And so when I say gestational carrier, they're like, what does that mean? Like, what do you mean? But so having her literally grow our child inside of her and birth her was just such a unique and special experience that was not on the table originally.
Right. So in a conversation about the choice you were making for the egg donor is when the surrogate conversation kind of sparked and...
Correct.
And then came to fruition. I want to go into the egg donor, but I also want to know why do you prefer gestational carrier over surrogate?
My understanding is surrogate means that it's actually the person's egg as well as carrier was the definition when you
look
into it.
That was like the legal definition.
Yes.
Maybe it's state by state. I don't know. But that was what we were told.
Yes.
And so legally we in our like legal documents, I think had to put in
gestational carrier.
And maybe that was state by state, but it's been over, 4 years since we were in the weeds of all this, but I do remember there being a distinction between what the technical definition of a surrogate is versus a gestational carrier. My memory was that it is where this egg comes from.
And then that's what you call her now. So like, and that's,
she's a good old GC. She's the GC.
She's the original GC.
She's the original GC. So that's why we use that. But again, like we could say surrogate and people, but like we just have always been, we've always wanted people to understand it is not her baby because people have such a hard time with that anyways, with surrogacy and like, how is she going to do this?
Yeah.
They really do. They think she's like, even my closest friends and family would be like, how is she going to give up this baby? And I'm like, cause it's not hers. It's not hers in any way. I understand she has a hormonal connection and she grew this baby and there's no denying there will be a connection for life, but it's not her baby. She entered into this with that understanding. It's very different than adoption where somebody is, you're not supposed to use this terminology, but like giving up their baby, that's not what's happening here. And
she's very practical.
She's and very
like,
pragmatic.
And wanted this separation as well. And she's like, yeah, so that was not an issue with her either.
Just to hone, like, go a little further with this. Gestational carriers, I'm sure you did all of the things. Like, there's psychological testing. They take tests to make sure that this is going to be okay for them. And they go into this knowingly. And I'm sure you did all the due diligence that is needed.
Yes,
absolutely. To make sure she's not going to be hurt in this situation.
Yes. And because it was our best friend, again, getting way into the weeds, but like even in the legal contracts, like in a way that I think a lot of people are, we wanted to make sure she was taken care of. You know, we were advocating on her behalf more than a normal couple would. Like there, I was talking to her lawyers down in Virginia to the point where they're like, you're not our client. Like we need to hear this from her because like, you're not the client.
Right.
And even though we're required by law to pay for it, but like, so we were really making sure she felt comfortable, taken care of in every aspect.
And so this is like months of us, you know, thinking about the verbiage that we use, explaining it to everyone. And then still, I would say like on a weekly basis, one of our parents or friends or someone would say, how's she going to give her up? And I'd be like, did you not listen? Like,
No, they don't.
We tried so hard to make it clear, but they just...
Women are specifically sorry to say. Yeah, like they just like can't... They put themselves into her shoes and again are imagining as a straight woman having a baby and then giving it away. But like, it's like...
And not saying that's an easy...
What's happening.
I know it's hard. And there's the fourth trimester that happens and there's no baby. And like, of course...
Yes, she had a hard time. There's no denying, but it wasn't about that. It was the postpartum of it all and the being all of a sudden alone. She's a single woman that lives alone. Yeah. And so there was another layer to it.
We had to do a lot of reassuring to our supporters in our lives that she would be okay, which is great that they're worried about us. They're worried about her. They're worried about the baby. They're worried about everyone, which is lovely. But then it's an added tax on us to make sure they know that like we're on it. We're all together. We are a unit.
Yeah. I think what in all my conversations that I have surrounding gestational carriers and surrogacy, what I want people to realize most of all is the relationship and the bond that is formed between these families. And I say these families because once you go into this like surrogacy contract, you become like... Everybody I talked to became so close with their surrogates, regardless of if they were best friends or not. And even egg donors, too, if they got to know the egg donor.
Ours was anonymous.
Right. Which is where I want to go next. But like what I want people to understand is like, once again, the intentionality. This is not something light and frivolous people go into and like, oh, yeah, she's just going to carry the baby.
Just put her in there. Okay.
This is so well planned out. And lawyers and fees and
oh my god,
cross all the T's, we dot all the I's, and we take care of everyone involved. So I just want people to understand that, and it's just like we need way more of these podcasts out there, so people can start hearing. We need TV shows about a couple who has a best friend who's a gestational carrier for them. Like, this is what we need. Why don't we see more of this?
Well, if we do see it on media, it would be wrong.
Right.
Or they'd be like, the surrogate
took the baby. Like, that's the only one that's going to get through.
Like, even that, she at the very last second wanted to keep one of the babies.
Exactly.
Like, every single thing. And so, like, that's what people think. And it was her brother's kids. Like, it wasn't even like a stranger. It was her brother's.
It's got to be scandalous. So, we need more uplifting stories that, like, show the truth of this. We'll be right back.
Queer Family Podcast, Love is Love.
Love is love.
Okay, so let's talk about your egg donor. Because I want to know how it sounds like you went through this IVF clinic that your gestational carrier used. So what was the conversation about? I heard the height thing. What else? I call this the search for the superhuman because sometimes we get a little cuckoo ca-choo. I got a little cuckoo ca-choo with my donor. So I'd love to hear everybody's path.
Some context before. I decided that I didn't really want a genetic link. I have polycystic kidney disease, which is something that with a lot of genetic testing, we potentially could have like worked around, but it would have also just cut our chances in half or in quarter. And, you know, and then, you're only getting so many eggs out of this and we don't want to just keep throwing money out there. And also my whole life, since I figured out I had this, I was like, well, I don't want to have biological kids because you know, it's been passed along through my family. I've seen many members of my family, like, have kidney transplants pass away because of this. So I didn't want to pass it on if I had the option. So that took me out of it completely, which was actually helpful. We never had that.
Yeah, it was easier because of that for sure. Like that side of it.
Yeah, so you didn't have to argue about who's going to have the connection.
Yeah, there was no question. It was going to be mine.
Yeah. And so that influenced a lot of our decisions with the egg donor we chose.
Yes. It was definitely a weird... a weird experience. Yes. You know, you go into this room and they just have these little, you know, those little plastic slips that you put paper in inside of like a three-ring binder. And it's like photos of the women, like, and there's like a handful of photos, like one of them as a child, one of them kind of like more recently. And then they had a very brief kind of informational form on the back of just kind of like medical history.
You smoke marijuana.
Yeah, like drug use, background, education level, but like pretty minimal.
Basic.
And since Philip was not going to be a part of it, his family has like Eastern European descent. So we kind of had the back end of our mind that we wanted someone maybe like Eastern European and tall, because he's Eastern European and tall. So we could kind of pretend he was a part of it.
I'm 6'5". I don't know if that shows here. I'm kind of hunching over.
I mean, you do look tall, but you're sitting next to Jonathan.
We joked that I should get a booster seat for this conversation. So yeah, he's 6'5", Hungarian, his family's from there. And so that's where we were leaning, was just kind of more people of, you know, that had the dark hair and the olive skin or whatever it might be. But ultimately, of course, we were just going to choose whoever like had the best fit. And then also once we choose them, they then still have to come in and do like a lot of testing to make sure, I'm now forgetting all the terminology, but like there were certain levels that had to be a certain height because they want to make sure they're as fertile as possible for the retrieval. And so there was like one or two that like just didn't work out, where they didn't hit the markers, or luckily the fertility clinic we worked with was just like incredible. And there was one even that they were like, listen, this is a commitment for these women and we need to know that they're responsible and going to do what they need to do. And this girl has kind of like flaked on a couple of appointments and we just think you should move on. We were like, okay, thank you for that. So I had to go in multiple times for, you know, with the transfers, you have to do STD testing, you have to do this sperm samples, all these things. So there was a couple times that I had to go without Philip, because like, why are you coming with me for these medical tests you don't have to do? And I had to sit in this room and I literally FaceTimed Philip and was like showing him the next round of women because the first one didn't work out. And so we landed on someone else. And after she came in, the clinic literally said to us, they were like, we think she's the one. Like, she's been so incredible. And also she is just beautiful. Like, she was just so much more beautiful than her photos. Like, this is the one for you for sure.
I love it when like the sperm bank, like when I was choosing my sperm, we were between two at one point, and I called him up and I was like, I don't know, can you give me any ideas? And the woman was like, I'll tell you what, this one is a lot more attractive. I'm going to tell you that right now. I was like, she was like, he's a good looking guy. I was like, well, what about the other one? Is he not? But, you know, I love when they like,
yeah, they were really advocating for us. And like, and I love that, you know, we worked with kind of the same, it was a small fertility clinic. Like, it wasn't one of these massive chains, for lack of better words. Cause again, in New York, there are some of these that are just like really big, like crank them out. And this was a, you know, a tiny little place in Chelsea. So it was nice to feel like we really had advocates.
And the experience there, the way we felt supported and advocated in that environment was just a total 180 from the experience with our adoption agency. And so that also made it feel like we were in the right direction. And, you know, maybe we didn't have all the answers right now, or maybe there will be tons of bumps in the road, but it's like, okay, there's hope.
Felt better. Yeah.
Finally, there's like light at the end of the tunnel.
Felt more aligned, right? You felt good. And that really matters. Yeah. I talk about that with my journey too, because I went through a lot of infertility and I was actually at a smaller clinic for the first 2 years. And my wife had conceived there as well. So we had been with them forever. It didn't feel right. So I switched. I went to one of those big factory ones. But for me, that's what I needed.
Yeah, I think it's totally person to person and what you need. And for us, the fact that
feels right. Yeah.
Yeah. And we were hoping to, because we knew we were going to be working with our best friend for the actual transfer. And my best friend, the other best friend, my business partner, had such a wonderful experience with them in terms of her IVF and having her child. We felt good about being there kind of from start to finish, because they would then also be able to do the transfer and monitor that side of it and not just be like an egg bank.
And it's a really good point to bring, like your instinct, your gut feeling really does matter on these journeys.
Yeah.
Okay, so you pick your beautiful, gorgeous egg, who's more beautiful than her pictures, egg donor. And she's anonymous, but anonymous where the child can contact at 18 type deal, or just completely anonymous?
Completely anonymous.
Oh, okay. True anonymity doesn't really exist anymore because, you know, we got these genetic tests.
We have one picture of her, and that's it. And that we weren't even supposed to have. So, but that's truly it.
Okay. I mean, you should be entitled to keep pictures, like, because you need to show your kid, you know, where she comes from.
Yeah, again, I think there was something about the anonymity of it all and, like, maybe down the road. But, like, this was, you know, just a, she was, like, 22, straight out of college, just trying to make some money, I think, and wanting to help a family, which is lovely. But it's not the same as, again, a surrogate that, like, wants to, like, that's where I mean about an egg donor versus a surrogate of, like, this was just, like, here are my eggs, bye, versus, like, I want to be a part of this family and be a part of the experience.
Yeah, totally. And it's beautiful. Both of them are gorgeous in and of, like, thank God for the helpers.
For these people that are willing to do that.
God's will.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, so I don't know why I'm saying God's will so much. I just think it's funny.
We're big God people in this house.
Oh, yeah, not at all. I know, not at all. Same.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we're recording this when all this Jesus stuff is coming out with Trump and stuff. So I think it's just on my mind.
He was a doctor.
He was a doctor.
Yeah, he was Red Cross. What are we talking about? It wasn't Jesus.
He was supporting the Red Cross.
Anyway, okay. I don't know why we just went
not
there.
A path we,
can't. You can't help yourself. It's everywhere. It's our lives. It's terrible. It's,
every day it's a new thing. Anyway, so the egg donor deposits are made by all and embryos are made.
So we only had, I want to say, 3 that actually, like, fertilized out of, like, maybe 12 to 15. Then we did the genetic testing by choice because, again, we just really wanted to maximize our, I believe in science, and I really wanted to, you know, maximize our chances here because of the expense and just for our best friend and for all of it, right? So only 1.5 were viable. One was negative, one was what's called a mosaic, where it's like something, there's an abnormality, but it can correct itself in the womb, so you can transfer it. And then one was like A+. And since we didn't care about gender, like, it was just like, yep, that's the one.
There it is.
And we were choosing to only implant one at a time because of the possibility of splitting. Like, you really have to sign all this legal document saying, like, you're okay with that. If you implant 2 and you get triplets times 2, you could have 6 kids. It's like, you know what? I don't want that. So we did the one and it took.
Yay!
And now we have our daughter.
That's amazing.
It was really like as truly, you know, minus the 3 years of getting there with the adoption and all these things. Once we got on this path and our best friend offered to be, you know, the carrier, things really just kind of fell into place considering how challenging of a process it is. Our best friend also lives in Virginia, so it's not like she lives locally. So that added another level of complexity for sure with where are we doing this? How are we doing this? As we mentioned earlier, the multiple states and their different laws. And so we had to have
Virginia lawyers.
And we had to look into, is it better for her in New York versus Virginia? Like, what makes this the easiest all around? And that was a big part of where is she going to deliver and where is this transfer happening?
Where did you decide?
Ultimately, it was in Virginia. It really wasn't actually that different between the two. So, like, it was just easier because that's where she lives. Otherwise, how do you plan this? You know, it's like you're just going to come live with us for at least a month, kind of indefinitely, as we wait around just in case. Yeah. So once we found out there was no legal reason for us, you know, like, if there are some states where, like, you can't get both names on the birth certificate, you know, and so Virginia was not one of those places. So it obviously was just easier for her. She still came up here for this fertility clinic, for all the testing, for the transfer, and that was definitely challenging because you go in, they do these tests, they want your lining to be a certain thickness, and of course hers wasn't, and we had return flights booked, so we had to push. So, like, we don't do things easily.
No,
but
it's not easy.
It worked out.
And then all of the OBGYN appointments were in Virginia. Everything was her doctor. She was comfortable with her care team in Virginia. And especially if something had happened, if there was an emergency, like we wanted everyone to be close to her because we can always come. It's easy for us to come. It's less easy in the later stages.
Yeah, she wanted the people to like that were delivering the child to be kind of people she had been working with throughout the pregnancy and not come up here just to deliver a child with a random doctor, which is totally valid. And I completely understand that. And so, you know, she would FaceTime us from the appointments. We did go down for like the 20-week anatomy scan. So we went down for like kind of the key appointments. And then, of course, we went down for the delivery.
Of course.
She delivered at the UVA Hospital, University of Virginia. That is where she and Jonathan went to college. So just another full circle moment.
Yeah. And the hospital is like right on, it's called the corner, which is like where all the restaurants are. It's like literally on, we call it grounds, but on campus at UVA. And so it was just like this very weird thing of like, she was in the hospital, we were waiting and waiting. And I would like go take these walks around my old college
campus.
Like waiting, having these like flooded memories of just like wasted dancing at these bars as she's like like literally waiting for a baby to come out. So it was that was a weird full circle moment.
Full circle,
for sure.
God's will. God's will.
It was all meant to be.
Oh my God. And the hospital, there were no issues with the hospital. They were all understood it.
No issues. You know, there was a couple of hiccups. Again, of just like, you know, we were in Virginia. This was like where New York would have been better for sure. Mm. Like we had to get a couple of exceptions that they did ultimately give us of like, you know, technically, so we ended up having to, it wasn't an emergency C-section, but after trying for a while, you know, she was induced so that we could like be there. And just for the people that don't know, typically when you're induced, labor just takes a lot longer because your body's not actually ready to give birth. And so it was a very long couple of days of just like waiting. And then finally, when it was time to push, she did push for a couple of hours and there just was no real progress because her extreme preference was not to have a C-section. And so we, you know, were willing to do whatever she wanted her body. Like, I don't care how this baby gets here. But it finally got to the point that the doctors were kind of like, you know, we'll do whatever you want, but like, we're just not seeing progress. And we just don't like to see a woman like do this for this long and put her body through this when like we're not seeing any movement. And so it ultimately was a C-section. So traditionally only one, because why would there be two? You know, the dad gets to go in for that C-section, but there was two of us and they made an exception for us to both be in there, which was lovely and incredible. But then there was like a little bit of a snafu of like, you know, that night staying over once we got moved to the actual mommy ward, as they called it, versus like the maternity ward. We technically weren't supposed to have two people in there. And so like, I literally had to book a hotel room last minute for one of us to go stay somewhere else. And of course, after we booked it at like, our daughter was born at 11:15 PM. So this is all happening very late.
And they're like, one of you's gotta go.
One of you's gotta go. So
crazy.
I booked a hotel room. I had gone there to just be like, you know what? I'm gonna go take a shower. Like, Philip, sorry, you're sleeping there tonight. It's my best friend. Like, I gotta be here. And then after we got put over there and we're like getting settled, they were like, great news. Like, we got an exception so you can all stay here. And I was like, well, too late. We dropped hundreds of dollars on this hotel room. Like, he's going to go. But thanks.
Wow.
I think the second night, did you ultimately stay in the hotel room? And because there was one night where I slept in the chair and you slept on the fold out bed situation. So that was like a hiccup. So there were just a couple of times where it's like, you just obviously weren't well versed in the right terminology and things like that.
And that stuff should have been taken care of ahead of time. Like, they should have known.
They did know.
They did do a good job with some things. They had at the top of her chart, it was say, don't say mommy. Don't say mom. Because, like, they really tried to get that verbiage in there.
Yes.
And, like, the two dads verbiage, like, everything. It seemed like they did their best for an environment that it just doesn't happen much.
Yeah.
And so we were we felt like the trailblazers.
Yeah, we certainly weren't like offended by anything. Like, nothing bad happened. No one like treated us poorly. No one was like, hey, get out of here. Like, what is this other man doing here? But it wasn't. There were a few hiccups that, again, just kind of come with the territory, unfortunately, I think, of being queer parents to be and in a place unlike New York City or LA that's just like, this is par for the course. Charlottesville, Virginia is, I mean, a liberal city for Virginia, but it's still Virginia, right?
That's why more of us need to have kids so we can be the trailblazers in all the places.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
So everybody let's all get on board here. I'm going to need a room with my husband. And if it makes you feel any better, I had an emergency C-section and my wife didn't make it in the room. So I was on my own.
It was a rough experience in there. So it was really good that I was in there because she was like throwing up, you know, as she's strapped down and like they had to like suction it out of her mouth so she wasn't choking, as I'm like literally holding her head as she's like shaking violently. Like it was just,
oh my God.
It's an experience we'll remember for the rest of our lives and not, I would say not good way.
Well, I was with the baby.
Yeah, it was pretty traumatizing for me, I will say.
Oh my God.
Your best friend, you know, literally getting cut open, the amount of blood and all this. And there's just, that's when it was like the level, that's where it was almost a detriment for it to be my best friend because I was so terrified of just like, I wanted to be just fully present in this like joyous moment, but I was so hyper focused on the well-being of my best friend who was just doing this out of the kindness of her heart that like, that's why like when that was happening, like Philip went to the baby. When she was born.
That's how it should be too, right? Like if it was your wife on the table, you'd be feeling the same way. Like if it was Philip on the table, you'd be feeling the same way, right? So that's how it should be. Luckily, my wife wasn't there for it. So
yeah,
she didn't have to see
Honestly, maybe better that way. Like, I don't know. C-sections are, oof, God.
She came in I heard her come in the room after they had just pulled him out. She came in the room and I heard her, holy shit, he's here.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Good times. Good memories. Good memories.
Childbirth.
Yeah, it's traumatic. No matter which way.
It's traumatic. Yeah,
and beautiful. And she gave you a beautiful, beautiful gift.
She did. She did. She absolutely did.
That's awesome.
Did.
Now your kiddo is 3 and a half.
Mm-hmm. She is.
And she's starting to notice that other families don't look like yours.
That's something that we've been very intentional about from day one. You know, as we're talking about representation, you know, obviously Philip working in the publishing industry and the book world, like we really have gone out of our way to find queer children's books that have, you know, multiple dads and their moms or families of different makeups. And it's just one of those things that like, you don't necessarily have the language to articulate. And so these books, even though they're meant for her, it's actually given us the language to communicate as well of like, you know, all families are different. Some people have one mom, some live with their grandparents, and they surely aren't afraid to ask and their parents aren't necessarily around. And so they'll be like, why doesn't Blake have a mommy?
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have those lines prepped and ready because of these books.
We use their language. We really think we're getting through to them. And then they're like, did the mommy die? And I'm like, okay, you're not getting it.
Blake doesn't know what death is yet. We're not talking about that.
Like, let's chill. But that's the thing. Like, we're talking about it with our kids get it and understand it. And also they live it, but we're constantly reading these books to them. We're constantly giving them the language surrounding our family makeup. You don't have a dad. You have a donor who helped us make you, and you have two moms, you know, so they hear it all the time. But the other kids, because they don't have to, because the parents just get to be parents in the world, are not having these conversations with their kids.
Well, and the parents don't know how to answer either is what I found.
No,
they're like, hey. And so like it's earlier on, especially if the kid's young enough, I a lot of times will be like, you need to talk to your mommy or daddy about this. Like, and kind of punt it because like, I don't know. I don't want any pushback about this.
I've even talked to some other parents like, you should talk to your kid about how babies are made. My kid knows. My kid's known since they were 3. Like, it's okay. It's just science, y'all. Like, you don't have to talk about private parts, but you need a sperm and you need an egg and you need a body and you need a womb. That's it. And it's really easy for the kids to get, especially when they're sitting there with their two daddies, noticing that their two daddies don't have an egg. Oh, my God. So who gave you the egg? Like, it's so easy.
Yeah, Blake understands that Aunt Caitlin was the one that like grew her in her belly. And so she knows she has this special bond with her. We haven't like gotten into the egg of it all, but like she understood because, you know, she's been very matter of fact about it. Like I was actually speaking with my business partner about this yesterday and it's never been like a upset about it or a question about it. But like she just will like randomly say to kids at the park or even to Philip's mom the other day, she was just like, I don't have a mommy. We're like, okay, all right. So we got to like maybe start these conversations, especially now that she's in it's preschool, daycare, whatever you want to call it. And there's no other queer families in her family, in her class. And so everyone's talking about mommy and daddy. And so even in our imaginative play, she loves doing pretend. Someone's always mommy. Someone's always mommy. Right, I'm typically mommy. Or, you know, Elsa's mommy to Lammy or whatever it might be. But it's, we're doing a lot of role playing with mommy for sure. So things are spinning up there.
Yeah. And she's figuring it all out. Like my son, because we're an all female household, we've got our daughter and my son, he's the only boy. He also has the task of figuring out what it means to be a boy.
Yeah.
Right. So he plays with like boyhood and masculinity. I feel like in the same, like he's testing it. He's saying, well, I'm a boy, so I wear blue. Okay. Yeah. You can all also wear pink, but let's go with it. It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, so he's trying to figure out where he fits in the world. And I think that's something our kids have that's uniquely special about them. They do kind of have to figure out how they fit in a world that wasn't necessarily designed for the family that they came into. And it makes them, in my opinion, way more compassionate and way more loving individuals and empathetic to because they see, well, he's probably not like, doesn't feel the same as everybody, too. You know what I mean? So I do think. And then when they get older, it's fun because my daughter's 12. Now it's so fun because she'll be like, she jokes about it. She'll be like, so in her Spanish test, she had a Spanish test and the question in Spanish was, what does your dad do when he gets home from work?
Nothing. I don't have one.
She's like, she went up to the teacher and she's loud because everybody knows she has two moms. She's like, I can't answer this question. I don't have a dad.
Sorry.
Of course you do. You do have a dad. No, I don't. I don't have a dad. I have two moms. You know, like her friends are being quiet, she's like, Mom, my new joke. You want to hear my new joke? I'm like, yeah, okay. She was like, Lola was being like really quiet with me the other day. Like she wasn't talking while we were walking. So I was like, you remind me a lot of my dad right now.
Wait, that's great.
Oh my God.
She was like, you don't have it. Oh.
Exactly. Are you here? Hello.
We're equipping them with what they need to get along in this world. And they're smarter. My kid, my 8-year-old, he tells people, kids all the time, no, you need a sperm and you need an egg. Like, duh. And the kids are like, what does that mean, Mom? And like, I had a mom say, oh, I haven't talked to him about that at all. I was like, well, you better start because Ryan's just going to keep telling your kids.
Yeah, so. Totally. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, whatever. Amazing. And it sounds like y'all are doing a great intentional job with little human.
Yeah, we're trying.
Did you want to share about your books and or maybe the wedding planning? Anybody want to get married? You do gay weddings, I'm sure.
You know, we do, but less than you would think, actually. There are definitely wedding planners who just like really target themselves as kind of like an LGBT planner. And we've had a handful. This is an unusual thing, but we actually work with a lot more lesbians than gay men. And I like to say that, like, I think back to us, like, as a gay man, like, we all think we're the party planners. We all think we can do it ourselves. Like, why would I pay someone else to do this? We're also type A, whatever it might be. And so, like, the thought of maybe working with a wedding planner turns them off, or maybe they want to work with a woman because a lot of us, you know, gravitate towards women and our best friends are women. And so there's something about it. But yeah, we've had a handful of like gay men, but we do for some reason attract more lesbians.
I have a theory. Cause we're like, I don't know what the hell to do. I don't know about flowers.
Yeah.
We need to find a gay man to help us. Cause we don't know.
You're not wrong. The vibe is very different. And they're usually a lot more chill than our straight couples, to say the least.
Yeah. And then your books. How many books do we have here?
So I am an 8-times published author, which is
nice.
Wild. My debut came out in 2020. I started with young adult fiction, all queer. Everything's gay. So queer YA fiction in the kind of contemporary space. I always think real world type situations are often more dramatic and also like help teens kind of process what's going on with their own kind of identity, and also like helps non-queer readers understand what's going on and what they might not be seeing. Also, I just love fun stories. So they're fun. I'm not trying to teach. And then I also write middle grade stories. I wanted to kind of go down get down the ladder a little bit into middle grade, because it's just such a fun age range, especially in that library world where you're like looking for anything on the library that's queer, that looks like you. A story about a kid throwing their small town's first Pride Festival. That was, you know, something that was really special to me. I write a lot of rural stories as well. So I have six novels. And then my other two books, the ones that are most recent, are actually Little Golden Books.
Oh,
I'll remember the Little Golden Book, the thousands of them that exist. Mm-hmm. They've started doing a lot of biographies of famous people. And so my first one was Billy Porter. I got to write a really beautiful kind of tribute to Billy Porter's like legacy, even though I know he's still doing a lot of work out there. He's done so much, and I was able to like get, you know, a man in a dress on a Little Golden Book. Like,
awesome.
It was so impactful. And I was like, this is what, you know, and this is for the 4 to 8 range. So like, this is what kids need to see. They need to see people who are subverting these kind of things, to kind of gender expectations and just being themselves. And then my most recent one, though they aren't gay, Judy Garland and Liza Minnelli have...
I mean, gay enough, let's be real.
Like, they're in the club.
Come on.
The, like, biggest gay icons of all time. And was able to really just talk about their incredible story and make it, you know, there's been a lot of ups and downs and a lot of challenges, and especially Judy's life. But to, like, write a book that was all about joy and really introduces kids, 4 to 8-year-olds, like... This person really existed, and she did so much to have the life she wanted and to find her place, even when everything was against her. And gosh, the art's just so beautiful on these Little Golden Books.
Yes, they really are.
Yeah,
I didn't do the art. I didn't do the art. I have some amazing illustrators that were partnered for those books. I publish under the name Phil Stamper, if anyone's interested. Yeah, you got pretty much anything for anyone.
Everybody go out and get the books, and if you're getting married... contact Jonathan. Everything will be in the show notes. This has been such a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Queer Family Podcast.
Whew. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I enjoyed it. And if you did enjoy it, feel free to listen to another or watch another. I have so many episodes for your listening or viewing pleasure. Just go pick one and enjoy. There's a lot. There really is. And also, if you really do like this show, please, I know I say it all the time, but please do consider supporting the show on Patreon. You're just going to go to patreon.com/thequeerfamilypodcast. You're going to pick a tier, you're going to join, and you're going to get that bonus content. And you're also going to get my love and adoration for the rest of my life. I love you all. Thanks for tuning in. Keep on tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Mwah.
Love is love is love on the queer. Love is love.
Hi, Deani. Oh my God, you are never going to believe what my wife said to me the other day. I cannot
wait. Jamie. Save it for the Patreon.
What? Oh, right. Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah. Okay. Listen, everyone at home, if you want to hear what my wife said, plus a lot of other things that I have been dying to get off my chest, and there are some things, y'all, there really are, you need to come join us on our Patreon.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's me and my good friend Deani here, the amazing millennial who's young and sprightly, spilling all the tea in our queer little lives and exclusive contents that you literally cannot find anywhere else, literally nowhere else in the world.
The link is in the bio. Come be part of the queer family.
Love is love on the Queer Family Podcast. Love is love.